The Night Concert Hall. Free Family Fest, November 3rd at the Adrian Arsht Center. First access passes to the free performance are online at arshtcenter.org.
Support for NPR Newscast comes from Sit for Less, featuring the Zoe Chair and the Very Task Chair by Hayworth, online at sitforless.com.
And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you today, along with Bonnie Berman, of course. Today we visit with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David K. Johnston. He's known for his work on tax enforcement and frauds. He's a 13-year New York Times reporter. His latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And he joins us from WXXI in Rochester, New York. Welcome to you, David K. Johnston.
Well, thank you for having me, Joseph.
So tell us the premise of the book, how we're nickel and dimed by corporations in cahoots with government regulators, federal, state, and local, I suppose.
Well, what I do in the fine print, as in the previous two books that I wrote, Free Lunch and Perfectly Legal, is tell the stories of various individuals and how they have run into what's being done to our laws. And Perfectly Legal was about taxes. Free Lunch was about subsidies. The fine print is about how big companies have quietly been getting the laws of competition rewritten in their favor, getting laws passed that force you to pay taxes to them that they are exempted from having to turn over to the government, taking away your legal rights in all sorts of ways, and essentially rewriting the rules of business competition to avoid the rigors of competitive markets. And I argue that this explains much of the reason that the vast majority of Americans are worse off today than in the past. In 2010, the bottom 90% of Americans' average income was at the level of 1966. 1966, when Lyndon Johnson was president, China was red, and Mustangs were brand new. And at the same time, corporate profits have hit unbelievable record levels, and corporations have built up multi-trillion dollar untaxed fortunes offshore. American corporations have.
You use the term sneaky in reference to stipulations and contracts for services, especially utilities. Can you explain that for us?
Well, anytime you sign up now for almost any service, open a checking account at the bank, a brokerage account for your retirement funds, sign up for service for a telephone or buy an appliance, you are signing away your right to sue, and you are agreeing to have any dispute settled by arbitration. The problem with the arbitration system is that it was set up under a 1925 law to allow corporations which had disputes that crossed state borders, when they wanted to choose to settle them through arbitration instead of going to federal court. The U.S. Supreme Court in recent years has expanded this to the idea that not only can companies force you to go to arbitration, but they can require you to individually litigate. So say you have a dispute over a company that ripped you off for $1,000. No lawyer's going to take your case. It's not worth it. You, if you do decide to go to arbitration, will have to pay all the fees. You could be living in South Florida, but if the company's in Seattle, Washington, they can require you to come to Seattle, Washington. And while in your lifetime you might have one arbitration, the companies have repeated arbitrations. Well, the arbiters who get picked for these assignments aren't unaware of the fact that their pay is going to go away if they become significant beneficiaries of the customers. And there are plenty of studies showing this. It's called the repeat player problem. So they've created a rigged system that enables them to get away with bad practices and leaves you with no redress. And I tell the story of a woman, a bus driver in Washington, D.C., who was sold a car worth about $6,000 with a loan and everything else that would make the car cost $30,000. And Wells Fargo Bank, which facilitated this, said, well, we're going to take your house. Now, ultimately, because of a mistake made by a judge, she got out of all of this. Two law students recognized the mistake, and I explained the details of it in the story. But it didn't change the underlying law that you could end up buying a car that's a lemon, and the banker could take your house for it.
When you were talking about the arbitrations and having to pay that the consumer, the customer, would have to pay all the legal costs, isn't that only if they lose?
No, you have to pay half the costs. You share the costs. And so if there's a three-panel arbitration panel and they charge $200, you're going to pay half that, $300 an hour for three. If it's a $200 an hour single person, you'll pay $100. You'll pay for renting the office space. You'll pay for the transcriptionist. You'll pay all the related costs, and you will have to pay those up front before your case will be heard. So clearly, unless there's a lot of money involved, you're not going to do that. And in many places, laws have been rewritten now so that the government no longer has the power to intervene when customers are being ripped off. Historically, state attorneys general have had a general power to involve themselves when they find a company that is engaging in practices that are anti-competitive, that are anti-consumer, that create various dangers. And we now have a number of laws that block this kind of intervention. In fact, in an earlier book, I told about how the California legislature passed a law that exempted a particular person from the laws against self-dealing. So when he was looting the nonprofit organization he ran, and the attorney general went after him after I wrote about what he was doing, he suddenly produced this law that nobody knew was on the books and said, sorry, can't come after me. The legislature says I'm exempt from this law that applies to everybody else.
So how do these laws get passed without anybody noticing?
Well, the number of reporters, first of all, covering state government has fallen away to almost nothing. There's been a huge decline. In the American Journalism Review, in two big articles, I think 12 or 13 years ago and 5 or 6 years ago, has been documenting this. So that's one part of it. Secondly, the people who are doing this are not dumb. They don't go in and say, we want to make a sweeping change and rewrite the law. Somebody would notice. They go in and say, we need to change this little thing here. And it may take them a year or two to do it, which if you're a lobbyist is pretty good. You keep getting paid for a long time. And then you come back and say, we need this over here. We need that over there. And pretty soon, they've put into the law these structures that get what they want. And in some cases, I'm sure that I'm just scratching the surface here. I'm sure there are many awful things that have been put in the law that I haven't seen because you'd have to know how to connect the dots. And if you didn't have the roadmap from the people who got the law changed, you would never see how, you know, this clause in one law book is connected to another law that's 50 pages deeper into the code. Hmm.
Many of these odd laws are also put on as riders to non-related legislative acts that get the publicity, but down in the fine print.
Very common and troubling practice. And by the way, lawmakers don't read the laws that they pass. I mean, they'll if anyone being candid with you, they'll acknowledge that. They never have. They never will. They rely on committee chairmen, party leaders, and their staffs to tell them what's in there. And so there's a lot of mischief making that goes on. The problem here, though, is that we are seeing this, and I document in the fine print, this wholesale rewriting of the rules of commerce and conduct that go back to the ancient world. And I teach one day a week in the Graduate School of Business and the Law School at Syracuse University, and that's what I teach. We start with Hammurabi's Code, and we come forward to show how business regulation has evolved through the years. And the principles that were built up through thousands of years of human experience are being removed from the law in ways that are very damaging to consumers, but nobody, literally in many cases, nobody has written about this stuff except me.
How do these companies and industries actually get their profits from taxpayers? You say that we actually foot the bill for a new factory for a big company. How does that happen?
Well, let me give you an example that goes to an industry I suspect a lot of listeners of WLRN have been pitched for and may have invested in. Master limited partnerships run by oil pipeline companies. These are promoted particularly to older investors as a way to get a high return and pay no taxes. Well, those companies, by the way, the reason you don't pay taxes is they're returning your money to you, And my analysis of their financial documents shows the way they're returning the money to you is they borrow more money from the people. So on that level, it's like a Ponzi scheme. On the other hand, there is an actual business there. They are running pipelines. Right. Back in 1986, President Reagan signed a law that exempted master limited partnerships from the corporate income tax. So the pipeline companies, as master limited partnerships, are exempt from the corporate income tax. During the George H.W. Bush administration, they persuaded the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to adopt a rule that they could charge their customers the corporate income tax. And as monopolies, the customers are forced to pay whatever rate the government sets. They were taken to court by the consumers, who in this case were Exxon and British Petroleum, and the Court of Appeals in Washington said, you can't do that. You can't create a fake expense. If the companies don't incur an expense, if they don't pay the corporate income tax, you can't force people to pay you the corporate income tax. This violates the doctrine known as just and reasonable prices to customers and just and reasonable profits to the owners.
Right.
By the time this case was settled, George W. Bush was in the White House, and the Federal Energy Commission went through these machinations I describe to get around the way hearings are normally conducted and have secret meetings. They then put this tax back in. It went back to the same judge, and this time he said, this is really lousy, and why are we even talking about taxes at all in these proceedings? Maybe we should just not consider them. But since this time you explained the reason you're doing this, even though they don't have to pay the tax, you can force the customers to pay the tax. Now, on one level, it's not a lot of money. It's 3 cents a day from everybody in America. But if you can collect 3 cents a day from everybody in America at the end of the year, you've got $3.3 billion. So you're paying, we're all paying $3.3 billion a year for corporate income taxes that never go to the government, to just this one industry, pipelines.
We were speaking with reporter and author David K. Johnston. We're talking about his book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. David, stay with us. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
It's Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. We're funded by listeners like you and by General Hotel and Restaurant Supply, hosting their warehouse sale and auction this Sunday and Monday, November 4th and 5th in Miami Lakes. There are chef demos and an equipment auction and items for foodies and those who love to cook. More info at generalhotel.com.
The Kravis Center presents Jake Shimabukuro, November 2nd at 8 p.m. Jake Shimabukuro. This ukulele sensations concerts feature an array of genres, including jazz, blues, rock, folk, and flamenco. Jake Shimabukuro, November 2nd at the Kravis Center. Information is available at kravis.org and at 561-832-SHOW or through Ticketmaster.
The disease of addiction doesn't discriminate based on age or status. Comprehensive addiction treatment and recovery are offered for older adults and baby boomers at Hanley Center. 855-718-2233. Hanley Center. Recovery for life.
And welcome back to Topical Currents for this Wednesday. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with author and Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David K. Johnston. His latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. You can email radio@WLRN.org.
David K. Johnston, why do Americans pay more for phones, internet service, cable TV than in other countries? There's a widespread gap between, say, France and Japan and other countries.
Well, we have almost the most expensive internet of the 34 modern economies in the world. And we started out, because we invented the internet, at number one in the speed of our internet. We're now 29th and falling, and we're behind such leading countries of the world as Bulgaria and Ukraine. And we pay 38 times per bit of information what the Japanese pay. And in many places, people have no high-speed internet at all. There are still large parts of America where the only way you can get on the internet is dialing up from your telephone line. And the reason this happened is that other countries, recognizing that the information superhighway, a phrase I've been advised by Verizon shouldn't be used because it's out of date, that the information superhighway is to the 21st century economy what canals and railroads were to the 19th century and what highways and airports were to the 20th century. So other countries, South Korea, France, Singapore, they are all building massive high-speed fiber optic networks with tremendous capacity. Here in the U.S., the model we've created puts the profit interests of Verizon and AT&T against the overall growth of the American economy. Verizon has been widely criticized on Wall Street for making fiber optic lines run past 16 million houses. Those are the only houses with fiber optic service in America, and most of them will never get fiber optic service. And under new laws that are being passed, they can literally, and Florida is one of the states that's done this, by the way, the phone company now has the right in Florida, if you call up and say, here's my street address, I want a telephone, to say, sorry, we're not going to serve you. You have no legal right anymore to a telephone.
What
actually,
does that
mean? At least 3 or 4 years ago, where I live in Miami Lakes, AT&T installed a fiber active line, and I still can't get the service, and yet the cable is sticking up out of the ground.
Yes, and this is because they've gotten these laws passed. In New Jersey, they only have to wire 70 cities, and the law is written in such a way that the owners of a very beautiful building in North New Jersey said, well, listen, we want fiber optic service for all of our apartments that we own, but we want to talk with you about how you're going to wire the building so that you don't damage these architectural features we've worked so hard to repair. And they were told by Verizon, which has confirmed this story to me, we drill holes where we want to, take it or leave it. What's important about this particular building is who lives in it. The chief ratepayer advocate for the state of New Jersey. Now, if the assistant attorney general in charge of looking out for ratepayers can't get service, your chances of getting service as Joe Citizen are zero and none. So the reason we have this very expensive internet with very bad service is because AT&T and Verizon and the cable companies got the laws rewritten so they don't have to provide universal service, so that they don't have to provide service to any individual in many places. It's some places they still must serve you if you ask for service. And so that they can provide slow speeds. The federal government's measure of a high-speed internet is to the rest of the world, and I say this after traveling to other places and interviewing people about this, they consider it laughable. We effectively have built for most of America the equivalent of a two-lane Irish road where you have to stop when the sheep decide to cross the path, and the rest of the world has this enormous high-speed pipeline. Guess where the fortunes of the future from moving data and creating products and services in the digital world are going to be created? Answer, not in the United States of America.
Why is that?
Well, because we have a focus on the idea that somehow the duty of government is to look out for these companies instead of looking out for the economy. Mm-hmm. And Bonnie, this grows out of, I believe, an article written by Milton Friedman in 1970 in the New York Times Magazine. Friedman, as you know, taught at the Chicago School. I attended the Chicago School, though I'm not an economist. And he said the sole duty of a corporate's board of directors is to the shareholders. And this has been widely interpreted, and it's built into every news report you hear about the stock market and business, that the duty of a company is to raise the price of the company's stock. That is not what the law says. And why we would think an economist would know what the law says, I find baffling. The only time a company has a duty to get the maximum price for the shareholders is when they're kicking the shareholders out. Why? Because it's an anti-fraud provision. Otherwise, if we had Joe, Bonnie, and David as the directors of the company and we knew it was worth $1,000 a share and it was trading for $100, we could say, hey, we'll offer you all $150 a share. People would think, wow, 50% increase. And we'd know that we were actually stealing $850.
Right.
So the problem is that these well-developed laws and ideas that were built up through thousands of years of human experience have been overturned through the power of corporate lobbying and the utter failure of the news media to pay attention to these changes.
Tell me, David K. Johnson, a big part of your book, The Fine Print, talks about how utilities just kind of nickel and dime us with things we don't understand. So I brought in my AT&T bill. Could we go over a few of the items? Maybe you can.
Yeah, do you understand it, by the way?
Well, no, I'm hoping you do. I'm not expecting you to necessarily, but I have AT&T long distance and home service and also internet service and my cell phone. I was wondering if you could tell us what the federal universal service fee, I spend 96 cents on that. Do you have any idea what that is?
Yes. When we had the AT&T monopoly, we had universal service, and it costs more to provide a telephone to somebody who lives in the Okefenokee Swamp or lives in Keapaha County, Nebraska, the least populated county in America. And so your rates as an urban resident in Miami, mine in Rochester, New York, were a little bit higher to cover the costs of universal service. And that way, of course, if your grandfather lives on the farm in Nebraska, you can get him on the phone. And if he needs a doctor, he can get a doctor on the phone right away.
How about
when we broke up AT&T, we stopped that. So now we have this charge that you pay to cover universal service.
It's only 96 cents a month, but that's $12 a year.
But times.
It's scandalously abused, Bonnie and Joseph. There's lots of evidence that the way that money is spent is not really to subsidize rural service. It's to put a lot of money in the pockets of Verizon, AT&T, and some contractors who are on the inside, plus a couple of the smaller phone companies.
Now, I haven't had a international call from my home phone in years. And yet I see, and I wasn't aware of it, I'm paying a worldwide occasional calling monthly fee of $1.29 a month.
Lots of people have fees like that that they're not charging for. Now, if you call around the world a lot, there are calling plans you can get that
right.
will save you money. And there are also other providers that AT&T you can use who you may pay a penny a minute. But getting people to pay fees, and they say, well, this way you won't pay $1.19 a minute if you need to suddenly call Australia, provides a revenue stream for them.
Okay, one more. This is on my wireless service, regulatory cost recovery charge again. So I'm paying it on both.
Yes, well, the phone company wants you to pick up the costs of their lobbying to get rules that favor their interests against yours. Now, the one you didn't bring up is there should be a line on your landline bill, a line that says something like FCC subscriber line charge.
Yeah.
And I'll bet it's about $6.50.
It's not quite that much, but yeah, it's
okay.
There.
Well, now that sounds like you're paying a fee to the Federal Communications Commission, right? FCC subscriber line charge.
Mm-hmm.
No, all that money goes to AT&T. That is the cost to connect to the long-distance network. And the Federal Communications Commission has something called truth in billing rules, and those rules say phone bills must be understandable to ordinary Americans. So a guy named Bruce Kushnick that I write about commissioned a survey of 1,000 Americans to see if they understood their phone bills. Exactly 3 of them did. 99.7% didn't, which means if you round, 100% of Americans don't understand their phone bill. And the reason they put all these little items in there, by the way, is if you go back and look at phone bills and electricity bills and whatnot from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, as I did, there are just a couple of items on the bill. If the bill gets raised, everybody notices, hey, wait a minute. But if you have 26 moving parts and you raise this one a nickel this month and another one a quarter a month later,
right.
Pretty soon you can do what Verizon succeeded in doing. Local telephone service by Verizon from actual bills that this guy Bruce Kushnick analyzed went up at 2.5 times the rate of inflation over a 20-year period. This is true all over the country. And there's one electric company that has 26 different line items in your electric bill, and it's just a way to raise prices subtly over time.
Now, I also have a Florida State Communications Tax. That's $5.69 a month. And City Communications Tax, that's $3.55. Are those really going to the municipalities or the state?
Well, Joseph, I don't know about those two particular ones, but many places in America now, there is what's called a gross receipts tax or a surcharge put on your bill to fund local government. I pay the for my town in suburban Rochester, New York, I pay a fee like that. And it's essentially a franchise fee charged to the company, which passes it on to you. So that may well be going to the government. There's also probably a charge for 911 or E911 on your wireless.
50 cents.
Yes.
It's also on my landline.
Yes. And on the one hand, 911 has saved many lives of people who had medical emergencies, accidents, and crimes. And it's been upgraded so that the system now provides for many people automatic location indicator. All you have to do is dial 911 and the authorities know where you called from.
Mm-hmm.
That's why one night I mistakenly meant to dial 411. I hit 911. Suddenly there were two police officers at my door because I hung up. That's been a good thing, but it has also been shown that in various places that money has been used to pay for all sorts of things that have nothing to do with 911. Everything from dry cleaning the uniforms of New York State troopers to dinners for politicians in out west.
That's been proven?
Oh, yeah. There have been audits and things that have shown misuses of this money.
You talk about Verizon and AT&T. Is one better or worse than the other, or are they the two big offenders and they're equally bad?
Well, they're a duopoly. I mean, when we had AT&T, it was a monopoly and it was regulated. And the purpose of the regulation was to act as a proxy for the competitive market. Since there was no market, the government would analyze the company and say, here's reasonable prices and reasonable rates of return and keep watch of the company. And we broke up AT&T in part because it was stodgy. It was incredibly reliable. But they didn't want to invest in new ideas and new technologies. They're like all monopolies in that sense. What we have now is worse. We have a duopoly. AT&T and Verizon control over 70% of the telephone business in America. They don't compete except in the wireless area directly. They have geographic monopolies. You live in this neighborhood, you have AT&T. You live in the next neighborhood over, you may have Verizon. So they don't compete directly, and their prices are not regulated. So there is no market, and yet they're not regulated. This is the worst of all possible worlds, and it explains in good part why they've been able to raise prices while providing, as I say, the equivalent of a two-lane Irish road while the rest of the world is building the information superhighway.
I'm not familiar with them, but I see a lot of ads for Xfinity. What's behind them?
Oh, that's one of the – there are lots of companies that operate on the fringes of this. Some of them are bulk buyers. They'll buy, you know, billions of minutes or a large amount of space and resell it to other people. They sometimes offer specialized services. I don't know that particular – I mean, I've seen the name, but I don't know about that particular company. But it's a common practice for people to buy wholesale or super wholesale from the big companies, which have lots of capacity – but they don't want to spend the money to wire your house. And, you know, there are telephones in America that are on copper phone lines that were installed in the 1800s. The first phones were put in 1878, and there are still people talking on copper wires that were put in before 1900.
Do they have party lines, too?
Yeah, right.
There probably are some small companies here and there. There are some mom-and-pop telephone companies out there, you know, things like Joseph and Bonnie's phone company with 800 customers.
And rotary dials, probably.
Probably. My best friend has in his home wonderful electronic equipment and a 1924 telephone, you know, the kind that had a pole, candle-like pole, and you held the handset for listening up to your ear. And it can't make calls, but it still receives them just fine.
We're speaking with David K. Johnson. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and author. His latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And you can join in this conversation if you have a question or comment. The number to call is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN. Or you can email radio@WLRN.org. I'd like to ask you about the healthcare industry or the healthcare system in this country and the abuses therein.
Well, it's a non-system to start
with.
It's not a system.
Okay.
And here's a number that should really put this in focus for people. It is widely regarded by people who study this, economists, sociologists, medical experts, that the best healthcare system in the world is in France. They have universal service. There's no out-of-pocket charge for it. They spend 12%, 11.6% of their economy on healthcare. If you just took what America spends above 11.6%, you would save the American people 6% of their economy. How much is that? Well, in 2010, all the income taxes all of us paid as individuals in America came to 6.3% of the economy. So getting universal service of the kind the French have for healthcare is the functional equivalent of eliminating the individual income tax, or at least it was in the year 2010. Mm. And yet we have 50 million people with no insurance. We have 30 more million people who at some point during each year will be without health care coverage. We have 45,000 people a year dying because, you know, yes, you can go to an emergency room, but emergency rooms don't take care of chronic diseases like diabetes or cancer. And I have three friends in my life who died because they were poor and didn't have health insurance who could have absolutely and probably would have lived if they had had health insurance. And I describe the system in this book as I did in my previous book, where I show how the operators of some nonprofits, including the man I mentioned who got a law passed exempting him from the laws against self-dealing in California, I think this system is immoral. But on another level, I also own a small business, partly. I'm the chairman of the board of a little corporation along with two of my three sons. It is none of my business what religion my workers have, what their who they sleep with, who they love, what their politics are, but you know it's my business what their health care is. And as a small businessman, why am I diverting any of my resources from our business, managing a hotel? Why am I diverting my resources to deal with health care? If I were running this hotel in any other modern country, I wouldn't spend any time on this at all. And that's one of the reasons you're seeing the auto industry move from America to Ontario, because healthcare costs are on the books of the government. And by the way, I have a daughter who emigrated to Ontario. I've spent many, many days interviewing people in Ontario, and Canadians that I've spoken to speak extraordinarily highly of their healthcare system.
So will the Affordable Care Act create or, you know, solve some of these problems if it ever is enacted?
Well, it is enacted, and parts of it are already in place. It certainly addresses the problem of pre-existing conditions. Mm. And it's very important that we address that issue. It addresses some other issues. But it's really just another sort of Band-Aid fix that maintains the system we have in which private companies make life and death decisions. We have death panels in America, but they're run by private companies. And one of the stories, you know, Bonnie, I tell in the fine print is about a man named Bob Manning, paralyzed from the neck down. He was a lineman for a utility company, and he was hit one afternoon with a bolt of electricity and went into the pavement head first, 35 feet down, and paralyzed him. I met him when he was fighting to get paid his workers' comp benefits, and he had 30 court orders selling him to be paid. He had been paralyzed for 35 years, and they were not paying him. I ultimately got him some of the money that he was due, not all of it, but some of it. Well, the insurance plan that he had and the company he had were later sold, and the plan ended up in a company that is ultimately owned by Warren Buffett. This company asked this man to die. They went, sent a nurse to his home, which they're allowed to do because he's on workers' comp, and the nurse, who was very aggressive, said to the family and to his doctor, "Why don't you have a DNR order?" That's a do not resuscitate order.
Right.
And it is perfectly appropriate for my doctor and I, or my wife and I, to discuss whether in some medical misadventure we want to say, "Don't resuscitate me, let me die." But for someone with a financial interest in your life to do so, that is outrageous. And I tell the story of what happened to this man in his fight. He lived 47 years, and basically Warren Buffett's company bought or was paid to take over his policy, and the payment assumed he would die soon. And he didn't. So they were trying to get rid of having to pay for him. And by the way, the company had another trick. Both the insurance companies that handled his case, they approved his admission to the hospital every time he had a medical emergency. And people who are paralyzed from the neck down have these all the time. and then they'd refuse to pay the bill. And all across America, workers' comp insurance companies do this. That means Medicare pays the bill. It means you and I as taxpayers pay the bill instead of the company. It's another way companies rob you blind. The government does zero enforcement of this form of thievery, which in Mr. Manning's case alone ran to probably $4 or $5 million over his lifetime. Mm. It resists efforts by people who come across it like Manning to take to court these companies to make them pay. You have to get the government's permission to go to court, and the government fights that. And this is a massive transfer of wealth, and it's one of the reasons your taxes are as high as they are, because instead of these companies fulfilling their obligations, they slough them off onto the taxpayers and rob you.
So the Affordable Care Act, I guess you're saying, won't address these ills.
It's the Affordable Care Act is a big step in improving access to health care, and particularly for women's reproductive health. But it is not the, I believe, the solution we need, and that is to bring our health care costs down in line with the rest of the industrial world. I mean, countries like Portugal, much poorer than us, have universal health care, and we don't. For every dollar in American dollars, an equivalent what are called purchasing parity dollars, that the 33 other modern countries spend on their universal health care, for our system, we spend $2.64. Think about that. How $2.64 when we could be spending more than the dollar that they're spending. We spend $3.64, they spend $1. No wonder our healthcare system is so expensive, and we don't provide universal coverage. And when we have people die, like the friends that I've mentioned who died, two of them from breast cancer, guess what? You as a taxpayer pick up the bill for taking care of the orphans.
Let's take a quick call or two before our break. This is Marilyn in Boca Raton. Hello, Marilyn. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about those initials on the phone bill that he was talking about that were being charged, you know, for government fees that aren't going to the government. But I didn't understand, or maybe I missed, how you correct this. Can I call AT&T and object to the charge? And will they take it off my bill? Or I know I've...
Marilyn, that's a real good question. Let me be clear about that. The FCC line charge, there are about 20 variations of the language on this, has nothing to do with the government except the government approved the size of the fee. The money goes to the phone company. It is what allows you to call from Boca Raton to Miami. If you didn't have that, you would only be able to call right in your local exchange in Boca Raton. And so in that case, there's nothing you can do about it except we shouldn't be letting people think the government gets this money when it's not a government fee, it's a company fee.
And we'll move along to Fort Lauderdale caller. This is Conleth? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, Conleth in Fort Lauderdale. I wanted maybe a little bit bigger picture about... and I don't know the name of the group. It's ALEC, A-L-E-C, is its acronym, I think?
The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC.
Yeah, and how it influences almost every aspect you guys have spoken about, and how much legislation they are really involved with, really directly, as I understand it.
Yeah. The American Legislative Exchange Council is a group funded by people like the Koch brothers, people who share their view of the world. They are the ones who have gotten these laws that allow you to openly carry guns or carry guns and say you can go to college class and have a gun in your pocket. They are the ones who have gotten many of these laws passed that are rewriting these historic laws that encourage competitive businesses. And they've gotten some attention from the news media in recent years, but very little. And the members of the council are state legislators from around the country. It's basically an affinity group. And they are promoting policies that take from the many and enrich the few by eliminating competitive markets, by supposedly deregulating. There is no such thing as deregulation. There's only new regulation. And to give you an idea how pervasive regulation is, baseball. Fun to go to baseball, but it doesn't have any significance in the world. Baseball regulates how many stitches are on the ball, what color yarn is used for the stitching, and what the yarn material is. Everything is regulated. ALEC has been getting the regulations rewritten to take away consumer rights and allow companies to escape the rigors of the competitive marketplace.
We're speaking with David K. Johnston. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and author of The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. We need to take one more short break. Before we do you have a website associated with you or the book?
Well, my name, David C-A-Y Johnston with a T, davidcayjohnstonwitht.com is my sort of minimalist webpage.
Okay. All right. Let's take one more short break, and we'll be right back.
It's Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. You can celebrate Harvest Drive's 20-year anniversary of Children Helping Children Sunday at Weston Town Center's Community Fun Day and Collection. Harvest Drive provides families a week's groceries plus fixings for Thanksgiving dinner. Details at harvestdriveflorida.com. Brought to you by the Children's Services Council of Broward County. Celebrities create an aura of excitement around the 27th annual Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival, featuring premieres of top new independent films and world cinema, trendy parties, and gatherings. Now through November 11th. Details and tickets at FLIFF.com. That's FLIFF.com.
We'd like to thank our corporate underwriters, Alliance for Aging, Hanley Center, and Jackie Abraham Jewelers. These corporate underwriters help bring you the programs that you enjoy throughout the year. Please join WLRN in thanking them for their continued support.
The New World Symphony, America's Orchestral Academy, performs half-hour mini-concerts featuring music from Rimsky-Korsakov and Beethoven, November 2nd and 3rd at the New World Center. Tickets at nws.edu.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and we resume our conversation with David K. Johnston. He just gave his website address. David, are there any fees associated with going to that website?
No. No.
You know, when I asked about if the Affordable Care Act is enacted, what I meant to say is if it's allowed to stay as legislation. I wanted to ask you what we can do. I mean, we've talked a lot about the problems. There are a lot more. I know you talk about railroad lines and all sorts of other things and bank charges for bounce checks. But how, as consumers, can we put an end to these practices? I mean, what can we do?
Bonnie, that's the really good news here. In the fine print, I show both things people have done, some of them very easily, some with a little more difficulty, to solve some of these problems, and I lay out a host of solutions to deal with these. And let me just give you two simple ones. I wrote a 200-word item for a small website called tax.com about how in California the pipelines were going to try and collect the state corporate income tax that we talked about earlier. Three people who read this called up the California Public Utilities Commission and said, we'd like to be on the, independently, these people didn't even know each other, and said, I want to be on the agenda to address this when the commission meets tomorrow to discuss it. That killed it. That's all it took. Now, it's not a lot of money. It'll save Californians $9 million a year, inflation adjusted forever, about 25 cents for every resident of the state. But it's a little victory.
Right.
In the neighborhood that I live in suburban Rochester, New York, we are being gouged by the garbage companies. And I have a whole long section in the garbage cartel and how they say one thing to stock investors and another to the government about how they operate and how they are jacking up prices and reducing service and creating a cartel. Well, in my neighborhood, we voted to raise our property taxes to have garbage collection done collectively. For every additional dollar that I pay in property taxes, I have $1.80 more money in my pocket. And I'm sure to some people that's stunning. How can you pay higher taxes and have more money in your pocket? Well, the reason is that our garbage collection district cost me a little over $200 a year. But if we had the old system, I was paying almost $600 a year. And there are places in America where people can cut their bills 75% if they had garbage collection done. And it's also more efficient for the economy, and it's a nicer life. Instead of a garbage truck from a different company coming down the street every day of the week and somebody having trash out on the curb every day of the week, now it's all one day a week and you stop at every house. The company makes a decent profit and we pay lower prices. There are a lot of things you can do. There's a whole section in the back of changes and reforms that we can get. But the first thing people have to do is know about these things, because if they don't know about them, then they can't do anything.
Let's take another call. This is Derek in Fort Lauderdale. He's been on a long time. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
Yes, my question was, well, the first thing I wanted to mention was United States Code 28, 3002. So you could probably look it up. People could look it up under 28 USC 3002, but it states, this is a commercial law code stating that the United States is a corporation as opposed to the Republic, which was established in the beginning with the Constitution. Now, my question is, you said that they use layman's terms, regular English, plain English, to trick the people. I also think that under the grammatical trickery, meaning that they use all capital letters with your name to push you in the position of a corporation, which is also the reason for that.
Yeah, Derek, you're promoting this idea that's known as the sovereign citizen. Not necessarily.
The idea that
your name rendered in capital letters is different than in uppercase and lowercase has absolutely zero legal significance. The United States of America is a republic. The purposes of the government are set out in the preamble to the Constitution. The government owns many corporations. And just as if you were to look at, say, General Electric in fine detail, you would see it is composed of many corporations, just like your body is composed of many different kinds of cells. But the U.S. government is not a corporation. It is a sovereign government. And things like the argument that you're being pushed into the tax system if you have all capital letters or being made subject to the government are bunk. They are absolute bunk. I've spent years writing about them. And let me tell you that 15 people in 8 separate cases that I wrote about who believe in this stuff when I was at the New York Times, after I wrote about them, went to prison. The minimum sentence they got was 6 years. At least 2 of them died in prison because they wouldn't give up this idea that things like all capital letters makes you subject to government corporations.
Mm. Were you surprised by many things that you learned in researching this book? I know it took you 4 years to do it. Were there many things that surprised you or anything?
I was flabbergasted by all of this. I mean, all my career as an investigative reporter, which goes back to the 60s, I have tried to learn the underlying principles of what I'm writing about. So when I was the guy revealing the LAPD's worldwide spying operation, the first thing I did covering the LAPD for the Los Angeles Times was learn about, well, how did we get police? Where did this idea come from? How did it develop and evolve over the years? And in this case, after I finished my last book about subsidies, I started thinking about, well, what else are they doing in the law? We have these laws now that in 19 states, and I'm sorry, I don't remember if Florida is one of them, but in 19 states, companies now get to keep the state income taxes withheld from their workers' paychecks. And it's going to be everywhere in a few years if we don't stop this. Billions of dollars that should be going to pay for government services are being diverted to companies in this way. And the workers don't even know about it. When I exposed this a little over a year ago, there were all sorts of people who, I had people write me notes saying, you're a liar, and I would send them the statute and show it to them, or contracts that some of these companies had with state governments. So there were a lot of things I learned that were, I was absolutely stunned by. I mean, I did not know before I started working this book that since 1913, everyone in America has had a legal right to a telephone at any address. You have to pay for it, but if you say, I want a telephone, the phone company must serve you. Not in Florida anymore. They got a law passed with no news coverage. They can just say, Bonnie, we don't want to serve you. They don't even have to say why. Now, they're not doing that because they want to get these laws in every state before they spring their plan, whatever it is. But that's the law in 5 states now. They can just refuse to serve you.
What's the advantage of not serving someone who's going to be paying their bills?
Well, maybe you're not profitable. Maybe you're in an apartment building with 200 people and only 30 people are paying for internet service. So, because their system is set up to do a cable that will provide cable, TV, and telephone all together, they say, well, it's not worth it to wire your building or upgrade the system. Mm-hmm. It could be for some foul reason. They don't like your politics. But in the book, I show how this is working, and this is really very troubling to not have universal service. And all of our economic competitors have universal service.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. It's been a very interesting hour. We've been visiting with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David K. Johnston. He's also on the faculty of Syracuse University, and he was a 13-year New York Times reporter. And his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Thank you very much, David Johnston.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph and Bonnie.
And that wraps up today's edition. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction by Paul Leary. Tomorrow's program begins with our Florida election ballot roundup with the president of the Florida League of Women Voters, as well as WLRN Miami Herald reporter Ashley Lopez. Of course, you can follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page. We'll have today's author and book link there. Also, many photos and features. Also, find free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website, WLRN.org. And what's next? The calendar. On this day in 1864, 147 years ago, Nevada is granted statehood. Though its population was too low to meet legal requirements, President Abraham Lincoln pushed the action through Congress to gain 3 electoral votes in his presidential election. Re-election. And on this day in 1950, 62 years ago, the birth of comedian John Candy in Newmarket, Ontario. Of course, he began with SCTV, probably best remembered for Uncle Buck. He died of a heart attack at age 43. One more while we remember the good war and hard times. On this day in 2008, 4 years ago, the death of historian, broadcaster, and journalist Studs Terkel in his beloved Chicago. Studs Terkel was 96. He'd been blacklisted in the McCarthy era, won a Pulitzer Prize in 1985. And we leave with a thought from Studs Terkel, quote, "Chicago is not the most corrupt American city. It's just the most theatrically corrupt." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 91.3.